Yeah. Would help if I hit record instead of just cue. That would have pissed you off in about an hour. Nighthawks discusses network. 3, 2, 1.
All right, good clap.
Yeah. So, I got a question for you.
Shoot.
Do you want to be an angry prophet denouncing the hypocrisies of our times?
What am I, Moses?
You're not Moses, and I'm not God. Let's talk about a movie. Do you want to be a mad prophet of the airwaves, denouncing the hypocrisies of our time?
You know, I think I would like to be an angry prophet denouncing the hypocrisies of our times.
All right. Well, let's get down to brass tacks then, man.
How much for the ape? Matt, we are back after a very long hiatus. Thank you for those of you who have stuck around.
We are mad as heck, and we're going to try to take a little less of it.
Well, who are you, person who is mad as heck?
Well, I go by, according to my my birth certificate, which my certificate of live birth, which is the exact same thing. I am Matt Foster, occasional movie critic, infrequent podcaster, sometimes watcher of Rick and Morty. I don't know. I don't have a lot of credits, man. Who are you? Who are you to ask this of me?
I am Trevor T. Trujillo, representative of the Fourth Estate, reporting for duty. And to that end, I think, for reasons that will become obvious as we go on in the discussion of our film today. Full disclosure, part of the reason that we've been on hiatus for so long, Matt and I have gone through some life changes.
Deeper voices, hair in strange places. Yeah, that's...
I've taken on a new job. I've actually moved back to the old stomping grounds in central Wyoming.
A.K.A. Hoth.
Making the news several times in the past few weeks for how cold and miserable it's been. But I am working for a news outlet in town. And for the sake of full disclosure, we should probably note that what we're doing here with Nighthawks Podcast is a totally separate thing from what I am doing professionally on that end of things. So one is not responsible for the other. One does not necessarily represent the other. We're being very editorial over here. We're not the news.
We're not owned by the mainstream media. Yeah. Yeah, just because Trevor now works for the MSN doesn't mean we're now under the control of the lizard people, the reptoids, the Rothschilds, or any other outside influence. We are, however, a little bit worried about robot Alex Jones.
What is my purpose?
Now, is that the implication that Alex Jones is a robot, or that there is a robot version of Alex Jones?
What is my purpose?
It is actually a robot version of Alex Jones that wants to replace him but has not yet found a juncture.
Oh my god.
Politics of the day notwithstanding, and I don't know how much longer we're going to have to keep it from notwithstanding, but...
Trevor actually has a remote control that will set off a Deathlock-style boom collar if I start just yelling the F-word like Spider Jerusalem. But...
You know, we kind of wanted to do something that, well, maybe not necessarily didactic, would still kind of speak to some of the things that we're going through as a country right now, some of the growing pains we're feeling as we move forward into the undiscovered country of the next 4 years. And so we have chosen...
I couldn't find my copy of Caligula, which was our first choice, so it looks like we're what do we pick as an alternative?
Well, you know, it's funny because we have been wanting to do an episode on this for many moons, for a long time, almost as long as we've been running the podcast. We've been saying, hey, we need to do an episode on Network. I mean, I think that was a very, very early brainstorm, and we've just kind of been waiting for the right time to spring it on people, and I think that time is now.
Sorry, I couldn't help the John Cena joke there. But
oh.
It's probably inexplicable to you.
It is, totally. Just over my head.
The time is now is the lyrics to the John Cena song. It is when it is not merely an instrumental, it is John Cena screaming that the time is now.
So this movie has been very dear to Matt and I, and it's one of those things that even in discussing it here, we love this movie, but we don't give it real heavy play. We don't give it real heavy rotation.
I don't know. I watch this maybe once a year.
See, and I'm a little less than that just because it's one of those things where it's a great movie. It's a fantastic movie with fantastic performances. It's got some rather noteworthy Oscar wins and nominations, but it is not a feel-good movie. You don't end 2 hours of Network walking away feeling pretty good about being a human being.
It's a good double feature with Nightcrawler in that respect.
Oh, God. You're in for a rough night if you do that.
That movie made me feel like there was something on my back.
Yeah, yeah.
Like I leaned up against something damp.
But yeah, Network, it is a classic film from Sidney Lumet and writer Patty Chayefsky. Some fantastic performances from the likes of William Holden, Faye Dunaway, Robert Duvall. I just an all-star cast, a fantastic script, and it's one of the great kind of prescient movies of our time. One of the movies that it kind of made a few calls artistically, and those calls have, for the most part, all panned out.
You want to make reference to the Roger Ebert take on it?
You'll have to remind me what the Roger Ebert take on it was.
He said, "It tries for far too much, ... But what it does accomplish is done so well, is seen so sharply, and presented so unforgivingly, Network will outlive a lot of tidier movies."
Hmm.
So I think that's supremely apt because, well, let me give the dime store synopsis. Network is the story of an aging, a pair of aging newsmen who one of them is on the cusp of retirement and he has a bit of a breakdown in front of the camera. And announces that he has simply ran out of bullshit, and he goes forth to rant a bit about the state of things, and it culminates with sort of the accidental creation, the premature creation of reality TV, as this speech is turned into theater, and he's trotted out each night to rant again. Ultimately, it conflicts about how to monetize this and how hard to push and how hard to do this and that and where the line between opinion and journalism, the various responsibilities of the Fourth Estate, all boil over and it kind of destroys all of their personal lives. Then ultimately, we don't want to spoil it per se. I don't know. Do we want to spoil it? It's an older film.
Yeah, let's go ahead and spoil it. Folks, watch Network, okay? Watch this movie. It's a classic. It's a classic for a reason. We're bringing it to you for a reason. It's a very much a movie for our time. Watch it. And then come back.
Ultimately, it results in a terrible train wreck that, let's just say it results in a death. This is the thing that we wrestled with that makes this movie difficult to sort of explain. I have a giant note on my sheet of notes from watching it that says, can this movie be explained? Anybody born after 1980? And then I put a question mark because I don't know really where the line is. But the problem is that Network was so prophetic that now it's like,
it doesn't come off as satire anymore.
If you don't understand that we're not supposed to have the media we have, you don't under, like, well, where's the satirical element here? I don't see it at all. like we have to take the Wayback Machine back in time a little bit and go down, back. But we have to go back in time to a more elegant era. The more elegant era of the 70s when lapels were wide and so was the divide between opinion and journalism. And, I mean, this movie, all but, I mean, to a lesser degree, the other luminaries of you know, CNN and MSNBC, but this movie essentially directly predicts not just the rise of Fox News, but also correctly nails several of the market forces that make it bad and wrong for the media to be structured the way it is now. Literally, just the satire came so true that it's hard to convince people, like, no, you have to watch this and understand that when this came out, people said it would never happen. We're sort of uniquely in the wheel. This is a dangerously meta movie. It's one of those things that's like an Aaron Sorkin sports night, a show about a show.
You know, you're right. And it actually, on this time through, struck me as being much more meta than I remembered it being. I mean, even on an artistic kind of Deadpool level.
Well, and one reason we love this movie is because we are in the wheelhouse for it. We are people that there's humor in this movie that is sort of physical humor about the production of the show. Things that are like in the attitude of the director and the grips and the sound people that are sort of buried content for people that have done the work.
Matt and I actually do have some kind of bona fides in this realm. We both worked as stagehands and production assistants in broadcast television. We also worked extensively in broadcast radio and internet news media. So we know this world, and so there are certain behaviors you'll see among the crew and stuff that struck us as being quite funny that maybe the layman's not going to necessarily pick up on.
But I think that aside, there's plenty of other content here. And in fact, I mean, if anything, one thing this movie took it on the chin a little bit for was being a little too direct. Like, it has some kind of right through the fourth wall, tied on the guy while he speaks his mind, kind of impassioned moments. But they're great moments, and they're mostly carried off. Like, there is, how to put this? This is the movie. If you're adapting Atlas Shrugged, which, why would anyone ever try to do? I'm told someone did attempt it a few years ago, but I've seen no proof, and I hope to continue to see no proof. But this is sort of an example of finding the upper limit of how long you can just have someone give a speech. I mean, it's one toe over the line. If these performances were any different, any lesser, it might be a little too much. But for me, it works. And I think for you, it works too, right?
Oh, yeah, it works a great deal. And especially thematically, you know, because I come from a very idealistic school of journalism. I come from a very old school of journalism. And, you know, we're the kind of guys who are still really hip to, like, Walter Cronkite and Edward R. Murrow. And you know,
and those saying who have really hip.
And, you know, coming from that cloth, and what this is thematically dealing with is ultimately the monetization of the news media. how do we use this platform to make money?
And now, the distinguished television news commentator, Mr. Howard Beale.
Ladies and gentlemen, I would like at this moment to announce that I will be retiring from this program in 2 weeks' time because of poor ratings. Since this show was the only thing I had going for me in my life, I have decided to kill myself. I'm going to blow my brains out right on this program a week from today.
What the hell's going on?
Prepare yourself for a perfectly outrageous motion picture.
Howard Beale went up there last night and said what every American feels, that he's tired of all the bull...
For sakes, Diana, we're talking about putting a manifestly irresponsible man on national television.
I am not putting Howard back on the air.
It's not your show anymore, Max. It's mine.
I got a feeling I'm being made.
You are.
I got to warn you, I don't do anything on my first date.
We'll see. I want a show developed based on the activities of a terrorist group.
Well, I'm mad. I want to make a TV star out of you. Just like Archie Bunker.
That's the number one show in television!
We're number one!
Once again, we have to give context here. Back when network came out, there was no cable television. You had a set in your house with a pair of rabbit ears on it, and depending on which way you kind of turn them or bend them or shook them, you would pick up different television stations. And what you were really dealing with is there were three big network television stations, the ones that everybody got, the ones that, because they were public airwaves, were closely monitored for content and things like that by the FCC. And so there were three networks, ABC, NBC, and CBS. And what network presupposes is that there was a fourth network at some point. And this movie is the story of that fictional fourth network, and would go on to predict the actual fourth network that popped up later, which was Fox. What is being discussed is this fourth network is really in the toilet. Their news isn't doing well. Their programming isn't doing well. So they have brought on some kind of maverick programming people who are wanting to get real controversial on air. And there's a brief battle between, is news under programming, or are they kind of their own autonomous thing? And what's pointed out is that news constantly is losing money. It's always running in deficit. And so they need to sexy up the news to make it more of a breadwinner. I'm getting really long-winded here, but there is provisions in being an FCC-regulated broadcast network. You have to devote so much time to public affairs and community affairs and news, as well as education.
Well, and another aspect of that is, politically speaking, And part of the rationale for that, and part of the rationale for standards of obscenity and content, were that these were going out over literal airwaves. You know, at the time, broadcast TV was much more the mode. It's not quite extinct now. Some people in places, it's still quite viable. The airwaves are legally treated as a commons, like the
public property,
like the national parks. Yeah, and so like a station has a lease from the public on their bandwidth and their what would you call it?
Their frequency.
And at the time, broadcast technology was such that there were some upper limits to how many radio stations and TV stations and how powerful they could be. The nascent days of TV, there was some discussion of, should this be a resource more like the internet, where encyclopedic information was broadcast over some of it, or political bulletins, or different countries actually took slightly different regulatory approaches. That's why we have the famous BBC.
Mm-hmm. Which is a state-run news agency.
Yeah, a lot of countries have at least one state-run or state-subsidized channel, like Canal Plus, which I believe is French. Coming to the point, there was at one point an actual obligation to carry news, whether it made you money or not.
Exactly.
Because it was part of your deal. It's part of your deal with the public to have 22 other hours of programming you could use for your enrichment on the air.
And so what wasn't regulated, however, was exactly how sexy you could get with that content. And I don't necessarily mean sexy in the full frontal nudity penetration kind of sex. I'm talking about, you know, maybe not necessarily the most responsible reporting, but it's still technically news. Good
like
example
your,
is
your hard copy Access Hollywood.
Yeah, yeah, there you go. Basically, what this turns into is Faye Dunaway is playing a very cutthroat programming executive type, and she's looking for the best way to monetize and sensationalize news to bring in big audiences and maximize the advertising dollar for that news program. You saw a lot of this kind of play out in real life when it came to children's programming, like back in the days of Saturday morning cartoons. We did hit that point where every Saturday morning cartoon seemed like an advertisement for a toy or a brand of cereal, what have you. So there were conditions put in. You're still supposed to be able to walk into any broadcast television station and demand to see their records on children's programming, because that is still a regulated part of this. And we saw a kind of a sea change in the style of cartoon that came out. A little more on the entertainment end than they were on the educational end, but just barely made it across that line.
Yeah, like a lot of people don't realize the beloved Knowing is Half the Battle at the end of an episode of G.I. Joe.
Yeah.
Was sort of an attempt to get just enough educational content in there that they could be blocked in what was supposed to be educational children's programming. And that was one approach people took. You know, another one would be, maybe there would be eight cartoons, and then at the end, like one kind of Bill Nye-type science show.
Yeah, I mean, there was a span there where all of those cartoon shows had that, what did we learn in today's episode? You know, we learned it's not okay to go take a ride with a stranger, or we learned the power of sharing, you know, that type of thing.
And that's why we kind of wrestled with this episode. It takes a bit of rudimentary education, which is either remedial or really preaching to the choir. The people, like, I hope we haven't glazed over too many people's eyes right now, but
basically what we're driving at, the theme of this movie is the monetization of news, which is a problem. Because once you start monetizing the news and looking at it as a regular revenue stream that needs to produce, then you start to be beholden to the things that will get you there. So that way, when we're fighting a war in Iraq at the same time as Anna Nicole Smith dying mysteriously, it's going to depend on which one is trending more as to which one is going to receive the most coverage. Especially when you're looking at an unregulated cable network that has devoted itself to a 24-hour news cycle that has to keep things as fresh and on top as they possibly can so they can beat the other four 24-hour news networks.
What I think is really interesting, like the first major point that I have kind of to make a note of, this is not a new conversation. And no. At some point, the profiteers won the fight. That was one thing that struck me immediately is, oh, it has always been a conversation that it costs a lot to have news bureaus, and it costs a lot to have foreign correspondents, and it costs, and the question, the answer to that question used to be, yeah, but you do it anyway. You do it anyway, or what's going to happen is everything will collapse and people will take back their bandwidth, and, you know, you'll get a Mr. Robot situation on your hands. So I think that's the first thing I wanted to note is that, you know, there's a lot of argument to intractability in our current consciousness. There's a, well, those people have just always been at war. Well, that's just how it is. The rich just get you and bada bada. You know, it's just, we're all just corks on the waves and there's nothing you can do. And no, this used to be different. And not that long ago, you know, half a lifetime ago. And that's one thing that just hit me like a thunderclap with this reviewing of Network that I never kind of sunk in before.
Now we know.
And knowing is half the battle.
G.I. Joe! When Network came out was not a good chapter of American history. We were not in the best economic situation. We were not in the best foreign policy situation. This was the time of the 1970s gas crisis. This was the time of recession and depression. And it's something that Howard Beale even makes note on, that times are really difficult. And so it's one thing when one of the main characters, this is a great ensemble piece. I don't know that I could actually finger one as a lead and one as a supporting, to make mention of something we've brought up on the podcast before. There are moments when people from the news department are going up against the network heads and saying, well, listen, if you fire me, then the whole rest of the news crew is going to come in right behind me, which is something that happened. People would stand unified like that in the 1960s with Edward R. Murrow, and they would make those big, bold pronouncements that if you're going to fire Edward, then you're going to have to fire the whole newsroom, and you can't afford to do that, so you might as well just let us do this thing. Well, unfortunately, in the 1970s, you can't quite pull that move because somebody might just call your bluff. And when you're the age of a Max or the age of a Howard Beale, nobody's going to hire you for their news program. You're effectively done. And you better just hope you have the money saved up to retire, because there's nothing left for you. And so this is a very scary thing for them. They don't have the backing of their crew. You know, the entire news crew is not going to walk out on principle because there's nowhere for them to go.
This is another thing, like we mentioned it in the discussion of Julia's Eyes. This is a movie where I believe the ingenue is in her 30s. You know, this is a movie that focuses around like slightly older people than we're used to seeing.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the core conflicts here is we have Max and Howard are friends. They came up together in news. Now, Howard Beale has great, great sort of takedown rants that are something out of Bill Hicks or Dennis Leary or you know, who...
Mm-hmm. George Carlin.
Such a good comedian. Hicks stole his material before he was born. But
I don't have to tell you things are bad. Everybody knows things are bad. It's a depression. Everybody's out of work or scared of losing their job. The dollar buys a nickel's worth. Banks are going bust. Shopkeepers keep a gun under the counter. Punks are running wild in the street, and there's nobody anywhere who seems to know what to do, and there's no end to it. We know the air is unfit to breathe and our food is unfit to eat. We sit watching our TVs while some local newscaster tells us that today we had 15 homicides and 63 violent crimes, as if that's the way it's supposed to be. We know things are bad, worse than bad. They're crazy. It's like everything everywhere is going crazy, so we don't go out anymore. We sit in the house, and slowly the world we're living in is getting smaller, and all we say is, please, at least leave us alone in our living rooms. Let me have my toaster and my TV and my steel-belted radios, and I won't say anything. Just leave us alone. Well, I'm not going to leave you alone. I want you to get mad. I don't want you to protest. I don't want you to riot. I don't want you to write to your congressman because I wouldn't know what to tell you to write. I don't know what to do about the depression and the inflation and the Russians and the crime in the street. All I know is that first, you've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value. So, I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
And when I watched Network in my 20s, I was very struck by, you know, those rants. And there is a certain media personality whose initials I won't say, but whose name is Glenn Beck, that... I think he also saw Network in his 20s and loved Howard Beale's rants, but what he never did is I don't think he watched it later in his 30s, because in particular with this reviewing of it, I caught more nuance and I understood when they start pointing the camera at Howard Beale and letting him, and you know, Howard passes out at the end of his rants, and the implication, although never confirmed, is that there's something. The guy might well have a brain tumor or the beginnings of dementia or something, and they're really trotting him out and letting him caper, and how angry that makes Max and how disgusted he is with it, and how it makes him reflective about his own immediate future. I never caught that before. It was so much more striking. But
right.
But for all the people that want to make money off of him, Beale is also kind of an MC Hammer figure. The sole person actually checking on his welfare, including himself, is actually Max.
Who is summarily dismissed for doing so.
Yeah, and then ultimately kind of brought back by ultimatum to linger a little longer in the plot. But we have, how does she put it? Diana Christensen, the Faye Dunaway character, when they're about to pull the plug on Beale, she says, no, the American people want someone to articulate their rage, and he's articulating the popular rage. And I was and that was another one where on early viewings of this earlier in my life, when I, you know, you get fired up and you're like, ah, yeah, that's exactly what he's doing. And someone should. And in this one, I caught a deeper level of satire. Like when Howard Beale says, you should get up, go to the window, stick your head out and say, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore. And then Max, I believe it's Max's daughter, opens the window. She says, I want to see if people are yelling.
I want to see if anybody's yelling.
Open it and stick your head out and yell and keep yelling.
I'm mad as hell. How am I going to take this anymore?
I'm mad as hell. I'm not going to take it anymore.
I'm mad as hell. I'm not going to take it anymore.
I'm mad as hell. I'm not
going to
take it anymore.
And she opens the window, and lots of people are yelling. And I thought it was a revolutionary moment. This is gonna be, you know, finally they're gonna throw him up against the wall. It's time for a little Robespierre in our time, but this time through, I really understood it more from Max's point of view and saw how tiresome it is that the whole country is being led to rebel by watching a TV program. And it's very much that, you know, the Rick and Morty, we were on the run from a bunch of governments. So a bunch of Ricks got together and they started a government, you know, in reference to Rick refusing to join the Council of Ricks from other dimensions. And Max is very much that kind of character where he's like, no, I'm not changing this. I'm really going to stop participating in it. And his initial decision to let Beale rattle off on the air was such a decision. He was almost willfully shrugging his shoulders and tanking both of their careers.
Yeah.
You know, because he by all means, he actually should have pulled the plug on him. And then the rest of the movie is almost him apologizing. Like he's in the position of caretaker out of guilt because he did it.
Well, and you know, we may have been selling our synopsis short here. Howard Beale is a Walter Cronkite era, came up with Edward R. Murrow news anchor. And these used to be really important people. I probably couldn't name two out of the three major network anchors right now. But it used to be that was a trusted brand. That was a person you got behind. You got behind Cronkite. You got behind Howard Beale. You got behind even up into the days of like Tom Brokaw and Peter Jennings. You know, even as late as that, you got behind and really just pulled for your news brand. Your news anchor was the guy that you trusted to come into your house every night and tell you what's going on in the world.
What's terrifying to watch this is how predictive it is because, I mean, the plot's literally about traditional news dying on stage.
Yeah.
And then we see, you know, we have slight, the besmirching of the reputation of Dan Rather through his own conduct, the inarguable besmirching of Brian Williams through his own conduct, the really sketchy guys you know, Bill O'Reilly is allegedly not the most consistent with his own moral behavior. If you ask Al Franken, he's kind of smacked around an intern, some things like that.
Or what's her name? Nancy Grace.
Yeah, yeah. You have these people that are, what were they replaced with? And this is something that happens as we move through the plot here. Diana Christensen, she decides the simplest thing to do to have a way of consistently programming a hit show is just to create some news. So she finds, they're called the Ecumenical Liberation Army, and they are very thinly veiled versions of the Symbionese Liberation Army, an actual kind of leftist terrorist group of the time.
I just saw some rough footage of a special Bill's doing on the Revolutionary Underground. Most of it's tedious stuff, lean hobs and two fatigue jackets muttering mutilated Marxism. But he's got about 8 minutes of a bank robbery that is absolutely sensational. Authentic stuff, actually shot while the robbery was going on. You remember the Mary Ann Gifford kidnapping? It's that bunch of nuts. She's in the movie, shooting off machine guns. This is really terrific footage. I think we can get a hell of a movie of the week out of it, maybe even a series.
A series out of what? What are we talking about?
Look, got a bunch of hobgoblin radicals called the Ecumenical Liberation Army who go around taking home movies of themselves robbing banks. Now maybe they'll take movies of themselves kidnapping heiresses, hijacking 747s, bombing bridges, assassinating ambassadors. We'd open each week's segment with that authentic footage, hire a couple of writers to write some story behind that footage, and we've got ourselves a series.
A series about a bunch of bank-robbing guerrillas?
What are we going to call it, the Mousy Tongue Hour?
Why not? They've got Strike Force, Task Force, SWAT. Why not Che Guevara and his own little mod squad?
And they also have, like, a movie analog version of real-life Angela Davis. They have a movie version analog of Patty Hearst, who is actually in this movie. The Patty Hearst kind of analog is played by Walter Cronkite's daughter in a weird bit of kismet. And they acknowledge that the Symbionese Liberation Army and Angela Davis and Patty Hearst all are real things. But then they say, oh, and then there's this other controversial terrorist group who also kidnapped a socialite, and it happened the exact same way, but in the narrative of the film, we can kind of f*** with these people, you know?
And some of the great comedy beats of this movie are delivered by the sort of leader of the militant ELA guy, what's the great Ahmed Khan.
Yeah.
We're to infer he's a black Muslim, I believe, but he just has some of this. Just a couple of those that he is in there.
Gross proceeds should consist of all funds the sublicensee receives, not merely the net amount remitted after payment to the sublicensee or distributor.
We're not sitting still for overhead charges as a cost prior to distribution.
Dog, f*** with my distribution costs. I'm making a lousy $2.15 per segment. I'm already deficiting $25,000 a week with Metro. I'm paying WMRs 10% off the top. And I'm giving this turkey $10 per segment, another $5 for this fruitcake. And Helen, don't start no shit with me about a piece again. I'm paying Metro 20% for all foreign and Canadian distribution, and that's after recoupment. The Communist Party's not going to see a nickel out of this goddamn show until we go into syndication.
Oh, come on, Lorraine. The party's in for $7,500 a week production expense.
I'm not giving this pseudo-insurrectionary sectarian a piece of my show. I'm not giving him script approval, and I sure as ain't cutting him into my distribution charges. You fascist! Did you see the film we made in the San Marino jailbreak out demonstrating the rising up of the Seminole prisoner class infrastructure? You can blow the Seminole prisoner class infrastructure out your ass! I'm not knocking down my goddamn distribution charges!
Man, give her the f***ing overhead clause. Who's gonna believe this?
Let's get back to page 22. 5, small a. Subsidiary right.
Or when he's sitting there eating the drumstick, and he's just, what the f*** are you talking about?
Well, just the fact that when they go out to recruit them, when they go into the commune, they're all eating fast food.
Yeah.
Like, of course they are. You know, of course, they just ran to a drive-thru. But, and then they sit and... The speed with which the business corrupts the ELA guys, and then we meet them once and they're terrifying militants, and then we meet them again
and they're in contract negotiations.
point by point determining what their production costs will be and
what their back end's gonna be, and yeah.
Of course her concept is put them on retainer, pay them the production costs to take a camera with them as they do their, you know, occupy university buildings and maybe rob the occasional bank. And what we were talking about when we reviewed the episode, when we formulated our thoughts, as it were,
a little bit off mic, a little bit of pre-gaming,
a little bit of tailgating is what we were really doing. I was having a hot toddy, but we were talking about how in the movie she has some legal concerns. You know, she says we're going to need someone from legal because they're going to come after us.
Yeah.
But it doesn't matter. We'll pay them off if we have to. It's going to be worth every penny.
Because you got to understand, the real-life analog of this is that there is footage existing of the Symbionese Liberation Army and Patty Hearst that they shot themselves that made it onto the news. And yeah. So what Network lampooned is they have then said, well, if these guys are shooting their own footage of their own heists and their own terrorism, why don't we just pay them for the footage?
What's really funny about that is Bounty for News is exactly what Nightcrawler and another movie we've tried to figure out how to get an episode together on, Strange Days.
Yeah, yeah.
The weird directorial predecessor to The Hurt Locker. What we were discussing is that in real life, the actual network that first really had true LCD unscripted reality shows, the granddaddy... were, of course, well, you could argue Unsolved Mysteries or America's Most Wanted, but the first truly condensed reality show was Cops.
I think so.
And
yeah.
And Cops was really, it had to do with the writer's strike or a director's strike or something?
Yeah, there was a writer's strike going on, and lo and behold, the fourth network that had just kind of become an up-and-comer and was kind of in the early stages and was an infant network that a writer's strike very well could have taken down if they ran out of content. Well, they were running out of content. And so this writer's strike happened, they weren't sure what to do, and so what they started doing was just paying police departments for their stories. They would send a camera crew with these cops, and it was a cheap production of television. You know, it was, you don't have to pay them what you pay an actor. You just pay to follow them around, and you get arguably gripping drama out of it. You know, something that I watched Cops as a kid. I thought it was nifty as hell. I would have a problem watching it now. And I think you probably still can, but...
My single favorite moment in Cops, there is an episode where a guy just bunny rabbits away from a cop.
Uh-huh.
And the cop goes running after him. You know, he parkours through some yards and stuff and ultimately hides under a porch and has to be pulled out. And these three cops don't really love to run in all their utility belt and stuff. And they finally get a hold of him and pull him out from under the porch. And the one cop is pink in the cheeks and breathing hard. He looks down and he goes, "Why did you run from us?" And this guy looks up at him and says, "Officer, I did not want you to catch me."
Honesty in television. Honesty in television, ladies and gentlemen.
But for me, that is the most interesting piece of futurism that Network committed to celluloid, is the idea that at some point there was going to be an inevitable realization that what was expensive loss leading news production was cheaper than fiction.
Mm-hmm.
That what wasn't being sold because we couldn't sell it would actually be an incredibly good revenue stream if we just found a way to sell it. And that gave us Geraldo, Hard Copy, Donahue,
Jerry Springer,
the Bachelor. It led to Mark Burnett. It led to Fear Factor. It led to, you know.
Well, and even in its own separate way, kind of led to the things that would then parody that style. And you're looking at The Office. You're looking at Parks and Recreation. One of the greatest things to come out of Cops was Reno 911, which was the parody show on Comedy Central that kind of ripped off that style. Arrested Development was another one that kind of had that fly on the wall kind of reality television angle on it, which is something that is even, Matt, I think you wanted to talk about a little bit, is even kind of reflected here and from other Lumet films at the time.
Well, yeah, and that's where we get into kind of the technical end of things, is this is directed by Sidney Lumet, or Lumet, if you're feeling literal. if you're a strong exponent of the philosophy of phonetic pronouncement. But Sidney Lumet is not necessarily the most prolific or most famous director. If you go down through his filmography, there are not a lot of misses here. This is the guy that did 12 Angry Men, The Fugitive Kind, The Appointment, The Pawnbroker with Rod Steiger. He did Dog Day Afternoon and Serpico with Al Pacino. This is a guy that directed Brando. This is a guy that directed Sean Connery. He also did one of the most kind of beloved adaptions of Murder on the Orient Express. Hey, he directed Find Me Guilty. That's maybe the best actual Vin Diesel movie. But this is a guy that a couple distinct things made up his style. So not only one of them, like 12 Angry Men is a famous movie about a jury deliberating.
Uh-huh.
And it's shot in this very tight, very almost intrusive way. And at the time it would have been particularly intrusive because the camera equipment was so bulky and the lights were so bulky. So that must have been a sort of unpleasant shoot. And in a way he was using the intrusiveness of the camera to goad the actors. Dog Day Afternoon is about a hostage situation at a bank,
which is actually based on a true story in that kind of art imitates life sort of way.
Well, and speaking of a fantastic piece of true news that was fantasticized at the time, the robbery was being committed so that someone could, he wanted to pay for gender confirmation surgery for his lover. So it was this very strange situation that got made into a movie. He wanted you to have some distance from the people. So he wanted to make you feel like you were on Team Bank a little bit so that you would actually be conflicted. You didn't want to turn the guy all the way into an anti-hero.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's filmed from the interior upper corners of the room in the bank. And that is where, although I don't believe the actual bank had them, that is where the security cameras would be. So in a very strange way, as Network predicts an economic shift in the news, then we also see changes in the stage production. We see the techniques of game shows and the techniques of softer interview shows like Late Night Talk. We see them brought onto the news stage in the course of Network.
Mm-hmm.
And so multiple points in this director's career, he predicted not just the economics that would lead to the modern media, but also
the stylistic choices,
technical things. He sort of seemed to be implying this is what's going to happen with these cameras are going to get smaller. Cameras are going to be more ubiquitous and we're going to be more surveilled. Some of his darker movies, and particularly in the 70s when that was the zeitgeist.
And I don't know. I mean, it may have been a stylistic choice. It may have been a prediction of things to come. But it may be also because for a fly on the wall, the best vantage point to see everything and to see everyone is up in the corner where you can get the maximum amount of scope, which is the perfect place to put a security camera, which you want to see as much as possible. So I don't know, you know, how much of it is art and how much of it is utility. You'd have to hop in a time machine and buy Sidney a drink. But
Well, and to be fair, like I'm making myself sound like a masterful bloviator, but Sidney Lumet wrote a number of enshrined books on directing.
Mm-hmm.
And so some of his actual thinking about production design survives him. I'm not just it's not pure fan theory. It's not the Minotaur in room 237.
Bones and shekels. It is the international system of currency which determines the totality of life on this planet. That is the natural order of things today. That is the atomic and subatomic and galactic structure of things today. And you have meddled with the primal forces of nature. And you will atone. Am I getting through to you, Mr. Beale?
Then he dictates to Beale that Beale will slightly change the character of his rants and make them a little more sour and a little more negative and anti-populist, slightly more elitist, slightly more realistic. And I personally think this is the last great prediction in Network, which is it nails the death of fact, because the entire time Beale is ranting, he never lies. He tells everybody exactly what's going on behind the scenes. He doesn't particularly talk down to anybody, but he says what's going on. All it takes is a shift in tone to make that unappealing and boring and depressing, and all of a sudden, his ratings start going down.
Because it's not what's popular. It's not what people want to hear. Which years later, Fox News would make a cottage industry out of. I mean, it's no question that the cable news networks are biased in one direction or another.
Articulating the popular rage?
Yeah, basically. I mean, they're finding a niche. They're catering to that niche. And instead of adhering to the popular idiom of we report, you decide, it is really just pandering to one side or another for whatever reason. Whoever is going to bring in the most sponsorship money is going to get the attention. And, you know, that's where we are. That is the monetization of news. Now, you said that things wavered a little bit with the B story, with William Holden and Faye Dunaway. See, I think the whole thrust of the movie is about corruption. And the fact of the matter is that William Holden is kind of the lone voice of reason saying that, no, Howard is sick. We need to get him off the air. This was fun once, but it's really not working now. We're going back to straight news. And he's kind of shouted down, but he is also complacent in it even after he is fired, because he is sleeping with the woman that allowed it to happen. And he is sleeping with the woman despite being married with children. He is sleeping with this woman because it makes him feel like a bigger man. He knows it's a bad idea. He articulates the fact that it's a bad idea. He is literally saying, well, here is my moment of hubris. I better take it, because this is the last chance I'm going to have to get this type of young fangirl, virile female trim as a benefit of, you know, working in television. And so he's just as complacent because it's his moral corruption that that's about.
And that's the interesting thing about Network is Network is a Faustian story where literally everyone is Faust. Like there's no, like watching it, you might be able to think for a minute that Max is the hero, that Max is being exploited by Diana. But at the same time, if you get played by your side piece, you deserve it. You know, I mean, to put it crudely, in the end, he cannot be considered the victim because he benefits. And in fact, he's one of the only people that walks away intact from the train wreck. And in a certain sense, that commutation of sympathy is an indictment of the audience. It's basically saying, you're going to walk out of this movie intact. You are Max. You benefited from this. You had your dalliance. I think Network was sending a message of go forth and sin no more, but it didn't take. The no lesson was learned, no progress was made, and here we have arrived.
Well, and I like the idea that you pose that it is a Faustian movie with multiple Fausts, but I do believe that Faye Dunaway is not necessarily Faust as much as she's the devil. She's the one that comes in with the promises and the promises of wealth and power and sex. She's mechanical. She is a machine. Lumet specifically told Faye Dunaway, I do not want this character to have any vulnerability. If you put vulnerability into the character, I will edit it out. He wanted this strong kind of, maybe not necessarily an ideal female, maybe not necessarily a good guy, a hero female, but she is a strong female presence in this movie without a shred of humanity. And so that led to us...
One thing we kind of...
Yeah, that led to us kind of pre-gaming about whether or not this was a feminist film. And I still don't know.
At the very least, is she a feminist character? Because what I think is that she is not in particular, despite being the articulation of quite a bit of feminism in the film. Because what the sort of pro column is that there is no standard hack jocularity about, here she is doing the job a woman can't do. There's no sort of affirmative action griping scene. There's no, not much is made of her gender, except that it enables her relationship with Max. Exterior forces do not sort of crack down on her for being a woman. That is not a theme in this movie, which is ignoring it and not focusing on it. I suppose you could make an argument that that is a form of feminism, but then her actual character is a bad guy. She's not real likable. She doesn't come off well. And then so that's sort of an argument in the no, it's not column. And then the other thing is, then you get around to, well, maybe yes, it is, because shouldn't she be able to be the bad guy?
Right.
You know, so it's this looping sort of onion of what does it mean? I maintain that's deliberate, because that was very much the women in the workplace conversation at the time. For the record, I believe this actually does pass the proverbial Bechdel test, because she has that long conversation with the woman from the Communist Party, where they're very clearly articulating their intentions to use the media for their own agendas. But I don't know, like, Network leaves you feeling not great at the end.
No, you know, this is not a feel-good movie. Once we get to the if-then portion of our show, I think I've got a few others that may lighten the mood a little bit.
You know, I misspoke when I said everybody's Faust. I really did mean everybody is the devil.
Oh.
Because Jensen... You know. Well, I guess everybody's selling, and for everybody to be selling, everybody has to be buying. So maybe they're both. But
two names that we haven't mentioned yet, which is nigh on criminal, is Peter Finch, who plays Howard Beale, an Australian actor who died shortly after production and before he won an Oscar for this role. He was the first awarded posthumous performance Oscar ever awarded, the second being Heath Ledger for The Dark Knight years later. And then we've also got Robert Duvall turning in a fantastic performance in his character, but it is such an understated performance that he just comes off as par when he's surrounded by all the other people who are, I don't want to say that are chewing scenery, because they deserve a little more respect than that, but it is the most dainty and skilled scenery chewing you've ever seen in your life. But it's important for Robert Duvall to kind of have a restrained performance, because it brings out those other performances in much sharper relief in comparison. Robert Duvall is kind of, he's one of the Network executives. He's where the buck stops until it gets to Ned Beatty. And so he's one of the major antagonists as well, and he does have his peaks and valleys. And when he peaks pretty high, but he's not on the level of a Howard Beale, who is turned up to 11 through most of this film, until he absolutely collapses from, one assumes, either health problems or exhaustion, you know?
There's a flight of fancy in the imagery here, where the longer the movie goes on, the more the Beale show looks like a tent revival, and the more religious imagery comes in. And it's sort of like they do the UBS logo in stained glass in his backdrop, and they're kind of, and he's dressed a lot like a
Jimmy Swaggart, you know, like a
Protestant, yeah, like a mega church figure. And it's really kind of, they don't go quite so far as to fire a bullet on religion. But they definitely say that...
I see what you did there.
They definitely... Oh, yeah, I didn't do that on purpose. But but they kind of do say, you know, what's that? You even think like a tube? You know, they kind of imply that the television is a new religion, that it's rewiring people's thoughts a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the other strong argument in this movie, is a sort of separation of powers in the media, that there should be news, fiction, TV, and film, that they shouldn't be blurred. And obviously the people that made it were filmmakers. They tell Amir Khan he's going to be the new Archie Bunker. He gets this look on his face like he doesn't realize it's a compliment, you know?
Which, I mean, if you don't know who Archie Bunker is, I mean, that joke's just not going to hit, which is why this... would you say this movie has aged well, or do you kind of have to have the context going in? Is it kind of like Citizen Kane, where you kind of have to understand the time and who these people were in order to really get this?
I think it survives. Like, you can certainly watch it and get some laugh beats out of it, but it is, you know, these are people that throughout their, you know, the Lumet style is very much kind of stage production, and this does have some of the, you know, we've talked a little bit before about how, like, we tend to blame it on some sort of old-timey talk, but there's some actual deliberate choice made on a spectrum of verisimilitude to melodrama. And this is one where some of the spoken rhythms and stuff are not the current fashion. But I think it ages sufficiently well. Because if you're the audience for Network, you're going to challenge yourself to import the context.
Right, right.
It's a self-selecting problem that solves itself.
We're hitting the tail end of our record here, Matt, but we did choose this movie to, and the timing of this, I'll cop to it. We did this intentionally. But ultimately, what are you hoping our listeners are going to take away from this episode, from our discussion here? What most do you want Network to communicate to them? What did you take away that you would like to then pass on?
You know my pet demons. One thing I want people to understand when they watch Network is the people producing your news care what you watch.
Mm-hmm.
Like whatever, you know, what's the little nursery rhyme? A little child went out each day and the first thing he'd look upon, he became. What you point your computer at, what you point your television at, is what they make more of. There's ways around some of that. Like, you can, you know, there are tools online that let you, like, if you're posting a, you know, you get a cool link and it's from some crummy blog, if David Avocado Wolf reposts something, you think it's good, maybe look to the actual source a little bit, strip it out of his framework. Don't give him any page views. Most of my thinking is like that, but you drive the news cycle, and you also drive your own perception of it, because, you know, at this point in time, everything is covered. And so when you say, well, the mainstream media, it's covering this, not that. Well, they probably are covering that.
You know, that was an actual moment that we had in a totally off-topic conversation. It was a political conversation. And one of our friends had made the offhand comment of, you know, well, this is what's going on, and the silence from the media is making me sick. And you and I both kind of hit him back with several examples of mainstream media covering this thing and said, hey, listen, you know, we understand your frustration, but that's not entirely true. It's just the fact that it hasn't been brought to you wholesale, dropped off on your door. It's not part of your echo chamber. It's not part of the thing that the curated list of your friends that you've chosen to follow are sharing. And so it's not getting to you. And what I want people to take away is that it is incumbent on you to seek things out, to seek out news. Not everything is going to get brought to you and dropped on your doorstep. There is something to be said about appointment television at 5 p.m. when everybody's gathering around the table to sit down and watch Network News for half an hour. And honestly, you know, what I do is I download one of the major news networks makes their nightly news broadcast available as an audio podcast. And so I'll usually listen to that the next morning when I'm getting ready. And when you don't have animated bumpers, when you don't have television commercials, we are talking, and I'm not kidding you, Matt, we're talking about a total of 17 minutes of content. That,
right?
That is not a huge life commitment. And if you watch NBC Network News, if you watch ABC Network News, if you watch CBS Network News, they may not be the best news sources that are available, but at least they are there. They're out on the news, out on the public airwaves. They're free, and there is some kind of modicum of oversight on them. You can at least be somewhat informed on the day-to-day operations of the world through one of those channels. And I think if you do that, you're already better than the majority of people, because most people now are kind of relying on the zeitgeist to kind of bring them information. And that's even more kind of a bizarre democratization of news and of information. But if we all surround ourselves with the same like-minded, same-thinking people, even though we love them very much and we very much agree with their lives and their viewpoints, it's good to get some outside stimuli every now and then. And that's something that's not going to be brought to you. It's something you're going to have to seek out. And that, I think that's ultimately what I would like to put out there. Be careful of where you're getting your information. Make sure it stacks up. And do your homework. And like I said, we're talking about, at a very base minimum, 17 minutes of buy-in. That's it.
There's a lot of arguing to and from the source. Like, I got this from this source and that source. And learn the media. Learn rhetoric. Learn how it works. Learn to understand, like, that, oh, this is what a good citation looks like. This is a source story. This is not a sourced story. This has our articulate and sourced quotes in it. This does not. If you learn to read news well, the sorting of your sources will happen automatically as you read it. Like, you'll learn to understand who does the work and who doesn't.
And that's the thing. If you're reading a news source that is constantly where their source is another news source, that's a bad news source. If you're reading on genericnewswebsite.com that according to the New York Times, this happened, that just means there's literally some guy who read the New York Times, didn't do any of the homework on his own, didn't talk to any of the sources, didn't attribute any of these things. As far as he knows, he's just taking it on blind faith that the New York Times is telling the truth, and he's regurgitating it, trying to get a little skim off the top of that sweet, sweet internet traffic dollar.
Whenever somebody adds a frame to the data, they add a little distortion. Like, the story will be Obama bill doesn't pass because Republicans vote it down.
Uh-huh.
And the added frame will be according to New York Times, Obama fails. And so you got to ask yourself, if I'm reading someone and all they're doing is rephrasing another person, why am I not reading the first party?
There's a lot of information out there, and it's all at our fingertips. It's all at a device the size of a credit card that fits in our pocket. The whole sum total of human knowledge is available. And we carry it around in our pocket. And that's a lot to process. And I think people genuinely, because we have this strong pride, we have this William Holden pride, we don't want to admit when we don't know something. And so what we like is a source that will not only tell us what's going on, but will also tell us how to feel about it. And so when you get somebody like an Al Franken or a Glenn Beck, who you say, oh, hey, I like the way they think on international policy. Maybe I also like the way they think on abortion. And then you start letting other people do the thinking for you. And that's what really gets dangerous. And I will tell you this right now. If a news property is doing their job, their personal feelings about an issue or an event shouldn't make a damn difference, because they shouldn't be reporting it from that frame. Now, granted, there is no 100% way of objectively looking at a story. There is going to be some degree of that individual in there somewhere. But to what degree we can kind of dial it down so we're more of an Edward R. Murrow or a Walter Cronkite than we are a Nancy Grace, and you're getting a cleaner channel of information that will then allow you to make up your own mind and be an individual imbued with freedom and liberty, which is what everybody wants. And it's all up to you. And I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take it anymore! Sorry, I said we weren't going to get didactic. I got didactic, but...
Did you knock the mic over?
I didn't. I was okay. Moving on to the if-then portion... Matt, do you have any recommendations if people enjoyed Network and are looking for something that's going to tickle their fancy again?
You know, it's a stylistic departure from Network, but one thing that hit Prime, like, it's on streaming now. If you have a streaming membership, you should be able to get it cheap or free, is WTF with Tina Fey.
Whiskey Tango Foxtrot, yeah.
Which by all should have been a bigger movie, in my opinion. The imagery of it, I think it just looked sort of like something it wasn't. Like, people looked at it and thought it was kind of a Hurt Locker style, what are they calling those, a Doc Buster? The kind of, the sort of thing that usually has a, you know, like an American Sniper type rah-rah. Let's put Mark Wahlberg in this and I'll relive a tragedy together.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not that at all. It's a very interesting movie about surviving as a foreign correspondent in the days of clickbait and the new media.
Right.
And I just think it's kind of a real sort of, it's got a lot of verisimilitude. It examines the entire framework of our patriotism about our foreign adventurism. It is definitely a movie that somehow manages to criticize things about the war and about the media without being anti-journalism or anti-troop. Like, it gives you a real look inside, really sort of shows you what people do and why they're alienated about certain things, and examines things like cultural blind spots we have that prevent, like, at one point, Tina Fey kind of becomes an informant because the female Middle Easterners will speak to her and not directly to the soldiers about certain things. So it's this very interesting just sort of exploration of what's going on in the dialectic right now. That's also funny, you know?
Well, and ultimately that's why I kind of didn't watch it, is because I thought, oh, this is just Tina Fey, fish out of water on the streets of Kabul. Is that not what it is?
No, not really. And she's not very, like, there's very little wacky 30 Rock style comedy in this. It's a different animal.
So what I would recommend, I've actually got two of them. Both of them, I think, are a little bit more optimistic and would make an aperitif, I guess. Although on one of them, it's a TV series, so it might be a bit of an undertaking. The first thing I would recommend is Good Night and Good Luck, and the Oscar-nominated film that's got David Strathairn and George Clooney and Jeff Daniels and Robert Downey Jr. It's got a hell of a... It's another media film with a great cast, and it's a little more literal history kind of a film, but it's a movie about Edward R. Murrow's kind of media crusade against Joseph McCarthy, and still, although while taking a stance, doing the responsible thing and offering McCarthy a chance to rebuttal and then letting the American people kind of make their decision on it. But it was also about the Bush regime, and in as much as it was about the literal historic events, it was a metaphor for kind of what was going on vis-a-vis America's relations with the Middle East and with Islamic faith. I mean, there's a lot to be read into there. Fantastic, fantastic film. A large reason why I pursued the career path that I did. Another one that is definitely worth checking out, and I believe about 6 minutes of this has been co-opted and thrown onto the internet. And I'll tell you what, if you've watched that video, if you liked it, you're going to like the series. But I have to tell you, the way that that particular clip was edited and the context under which it is presented is kind of bullshit, but I'm talking about The Newsroom from Aaron Sorkin. It also has Jeff Daniels in it. And it is like Network, kind of a fictional representation of a 24-hour news network and kind of them putting together their one big roundup with their one last Walter Cronkite-esque news anchor. And, you know, yeah, it's Aaron Sorkin, so there's a little of who's sleeping with who and who's making out with who, but there's also this great social...
A little bit of talking in hallways.
Yeah, there's this great social commentary about, you know, what is the news, what is... And they use actual historic events to kind of spur the story along, you know. They'll be having their personal drama, but then all of a sudden they hear about an oil spill off the Gulf of Mexico. And you realize that, you know, what story they're going to be covering. It's a really great look on the inside, and it's almost kind of a flip side of Network. This one is a series that kind of starts with news media in the toilet and them kind of making a responsible news network again. And it all starts with one of my favorite quotes from the show is, like, after they've gotten to the point where it's like, hey, we're just going to do this because it's the right thing to do.
She's indifferent to ratings, competition, corporate concerns, and generally speaking, consequences.
Good, because you just described my job. I'm Don Quixote. You can be Sancho. She'll be Dulcinea, and everyone out there is the horse.
donkey. How did you know about that conversation?
I know everything. Anchors having an opinion isn't a new phenomenon. Murrow had one, and that was the end of McCarthy. Cronkite had one, and that was the end of Vietnam.
I'm not those guys.
I'm betting all my money on you're wrong. You know what, kiddo? In the old days of about 10 minutes ago, we did the news well. You know how? We just decided to.
You know, we figured out that's what we wanted to do. Now, that's a huge flight of fancy, because if you were to actually do that in real life, you have billions of dollars to contend with. And if I do have one complaint of, you know, especially the last two seasons of The Newsroom, is that the antagonists kind of roll over a little easy. But it is a fantastic series. I think it's got a lot of great social commentary. Now, a lot of people find that Aaron Sorkin is a bit of a leftist blowhard. And if that's your take, that's your take. But I do enjoy this show a great deal. And I highly recommend it. I think it would pair well with Network. It would pair well with Good Night and Good Luck. And I think to a certain degree probably would pair well with Whiskey Tango Foxtrot. So
we should also plug Looper just because it also has Jeff Daniels in it. It's awesome.
That's just your way of segueing into the fact that Rian Johnson directed Looper, and Rian Johnson is also directing Star Wars Episode 8.
That's true. That's an actual thing.
And you like talking about Star Wars. Speaking of... And it's coming up in less than 12 months. We've got yet another Star Wars movie coming up.
Speaking of things that have an 8 in them, that are political that we could plug... I do like that 538 podcast.
Yeah, 538 podcast helped me get through some of the darker days of the election. So a quick plug for them.
Should we do the thing? Is it almost that time?
I think it's almost that time. Matt, we have recently kind of launched our own web product. Are we ready to give that out?
I think we should start giving that out. And maybe people will start going to it, and then I'll have to fix it.
Yes, we do have a rudimentary website. We're looking to kind of splinter off on our own. So find us at nighthawkspodcast.com, where you can find the show notes, at least for this episode, and as well as some print reviews. We're also going to have some other things going up in the days to come as well. Find us on Stitcher. Find us on iTunes. If you utilize either one of those, leave us a review, leave us a rating, and ultimately tell your friends about us. Honestly, that's if you want to do us a solid, that's how you get the word out. If you like what you hear, let people know, and maybe they'll tune in too. And I've left Matt speechless.
No, I was waiting for you to say the thing that we say at the end.
We say a thing at the end? Oh, it's been so long.
We do. We say a thing at the end of...
We've forgotten. Well, do you want to say it or should I say it?
No, I was going to say stay classy, San Francisco, after you said it.
All right. Well, we're going to sign off because it's almost morning.
Stay classy, San Francisco.
Isn't it San Diego?
And thanks for stopping by.
Is your mom there?
No, I'm home alone.
Well, you won a prize. What's your address?
42 Oak Street.
Hey, Roblox, some stranger's bringing me a prize.
A stranger, huh? All he wanted to bring you was trouble. Remember, never tell anyone you're home alone and never give anyone your address.
I'll say mom can't come to the phone.
Smart thinking.
Now I know.
And knowing is half the battle.
G.I. Joe!